from New York City, it's the Gary Moore Show. And now, your host, Gary Moore.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Today, we're going to have an original, in-depth investigative report, the only one of its kind. I believe that we should share this with as many people as you can, especially if you know someone within the health profession, physicians, nurses, administrators, because this will show you the truth about what has become the medical-industrial complex and what happens when they're doing the wrong therapies for the right reasons on people who support them and trust them and end up damaged or dead because of it. This is a very serious report. It's taken years to do this, and we've had at least four PhD MDs working on it, plus a researcher to help us bring it up to date. So all of our figures are as new as figures are available. We always start with the latest in health and nutrition, and then to a person who emailed me recently and suggested that they're not using aborted fetal cells. That's just a scare tactic in vaccines, and that the anti-vaccine people are irresponsible, uneducated, and putting the rest of society at danger, especially children and the elderly, for not getting their flu vaccines or their other vaccines. I will address this person with all their certainty, with facts. And it will not be me making the claim. It will be Dr. Stanley Plotkin. He, by the way, is considered the godfather of modern vaccinology in the United States. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing, giving us what we can be optimistic about, what we can use, what we can implement today. The first study comes from Rowett Institute, which is a respected research institute in the United Kingdom. And they looked at a landmark study as showing the link between diet and dementia. Now, elderly people, especially in assisted living or nursing homes, are being looked at as the key to the effect of diet in Alzheimer's. And they wanted to see in this study what would happen with a standard diet plus a healthier diet, and looking at microbes, including bacteria inside the human gut, known as the gut microbiota. And what they found is people who consume a varied diet, high in fibers and fruits and vegetables, are known to have a wide range of good bacteria in their gut. And a diverse and balanced population of gut microbiota is known to be important for maintaining a strong immune system, as well as aiding in good digestion and assimilation. And increasingly, research has also discovered links between gut health and obesity, with people who have a lower variety of bacteria or lacking specific types of bacteria being more prone to weight gain. However, there's also increasing evidence that suggests that the gut microbiota is a key link between specific nutrients and brain function. And I've said it many times, the healthier the diet, the healthier brain. If you have an anti-inflammatory diet, that's your plant-based diet, and lots of juices, green juices, and berry juices, help turn off inflammation inside the cells and actually have nutrients that will repair damage to the cell. So when you have a glass of fresh beet juice and apple juice, orange juice, grapefruit juice, grape juice, vegetable juice like celery and cucumber and apple, you're actually repairing damage that's been done that otherwise wouldn't be done. And that's what the scientists at the Rowett Institute found, and that there's a two-way communication between the gut microbiome and the brain. Quote, It has become evident that there is a two-way communication between the gut microbiome and the brain. That relationship is not fully understood, but the goal for us is to identify whether changes in the diet can affect the clinical symptoms associated with dementia. The study is the first of its kind and could lead to the possibility of dietary interventions as a solution to prevent behavioral and psychosocial issues that are associated with adverse outcomes as well as distressing to people with dementia, their families, and careers. So we know that already. They're going to find that out with their study. But for anyone in this audience who has had a radical change in your diet, and I mean radical change, where you've changed everything that's bad for everything that's good, where you were promoting bad bacteria with sugars and refined carbohydrates and pastas and breads and pretzels and potato chips and pizzas, now you're promoting good bacteria. And we know that you have two brains. You have one brain in the cranium, the skull, and that's the one historically that we said that's the brain. But now we know we have another brain in the intestine, because you also have neurotransmitters in the intestine. We never knew this before. So you have two processes that occur. The gut processes the food and then sends messages to the brain. The brain then sends messages out to the body. So when you think a happy thought, when you sing a happy song, when you share a positive moment, whatever it may be, you're sending a positive message to every cell in your body. We now know that that turns on the immune response, meaning you're now healthier, you're more positive, and you'll have a better way of dealing with the viruses and bacteria that we are all going to be coming into contact with. But we all don't need to get sick because we've come into contact with them. I had the advantage that some of you probably had of spending time in nature when I was growing up. Our family lived in a little house on Covert Street on the corner, about 1,000 square feet. And during the Great Depression, a lot of people lived there. My father's sisters lived there. And then my mother's brother lived there. So you imagine all of us living in a 1,000-square-foot apartment. We must have had six of us sleeping in one bedroom, all of the cousins and my brothers, three to a bed, I remember that, and with one bathroom in the house. And woe to the person that had constipation, because if you were behind, you had a big problem. So we had to get up early because we knew who was constipated, and that was always the people that were the big meat eaters. In any case, my father also had an arrangement with a man who had a farm, a really nice farm, what's called a working farm, a truck farm, out of the city about 8 miles, overlooking Blenheim Hesed Island on the Ohio River. And those were my fondest days of being out there and spending time out there. I remember taking a bath in a bathtub in the backyard. Big pasture. There I am in the middle of this bathtub where water was poured over you. It soaked out and poured water over, and the water would go over you in and out the drain. It was a little rudimentary, but it worked. And the breezes in the summer sitting on a swing overlooking the river, that was special. Here's the deal. Out there on a farm, when you get up early in the morning at 3 o'clock and you go out and you milk 36 cows, you're around microorganisms you would not find normally. And growing up on farms, you're exposed to danders and manures and grasses, pollens, that you would never come into contact with living just in a suburban or urban environment. And it strengthens your immune system. And we can now prove that those who grew up on a farm have a stronger immune system, because they're exposed to more. Now, the key is you're always going to be living in an environment that has a lot of things your body has to fight. Touching a dollar bill, there's 3,000 different bacteria on almost every dollar bill. I mean, that's the way it works. You can get herpes eating in a restaurant. People think it's sexually transmitted. Indeed, it can be transmitted with a kiss, shaking hands, non-sterile glasses in a restaurant. And I don't know of a restaurant that sterilizes. The local restaurants, they don't sterilize anything. They wash them, they don't sterilize them. And that's how it's so easy. Ask anyone who works in the hospital. Anyone. Ask any nurse. Do you have hepatitis? Do you have the antibodies to it? Yep, they do. And almost every other virus and bacteria you can imagine. It doesn't mean they all get sick. The key is our immune system. If you build a strong, vital immune system, then when you come into contact with pathogens, your body will identify it, create an antibody response, and now that you have your immune system turned on because you're a happy camper, you're able to get through that. That's the way it works. Now we have a whole generation, the entire X generation, was exposed to the idea that to raise a child, you have to protect them from everything in life. I never once was driven to school. We walked to school. We walked home from school. Today, a parent could be charged with parental neglect and fined or arrested if their child goes to school alone. This is how bad it's gotten. So imagine that you're overly protective of your child so the child doesn't have a normal exposure to the microorganisms that they have to coexist with throughout their lifespan. They're the ones who are going to end up protected by giving them all the vaccines, which destroys their immune system, and then exposing them to all the allergens in the typical American diet with none of the advantages. So everything works against the child. Nothing's working for them. And then you wonder why we end up with a whole nation of sickly adults. That's one of the reasons. So, it happens in the gut. And the old natural hygienist knew it. And I was very young when I first met these very old hygienists. I was invited to a weekend retreat upstate. It was an old, dilapidated environment. The house was dilapidated. The swimming pool had not been used in a long time. It was all empty. And everything there looked like it had been in some dystopian movie. And yet, here were all these people, very upbeat, very positive, very nice. And all they could talk about was your health begins in your intestine. I really didn't understand what they were saying. Intellectually, I did, but I couldn't put it all together. But later, after I met Herbert Shelton and many other natural hygienists who headed the movement, Pablo Arola, Dr. Walker, and I got their input, then I understood. When you eat anything, drink anything that is damaging to the immune system, damaged to the body, you're sending the wrong message and you're creating the wrong bacteria. You're creating the very bacteria that will precipitate disease. When you detox, you're cleansing all that bad bacteria out, you're flushing it out, you're radically expelling it, and then you're laying down a whole new bacteria. That bacteria is not just bacteria. It actually communicates through a neuron transmission to the brain. So everything you eat and everything you shouldn't eat, you're going to have an immediate immune response. I mean, haven't you ever tried something you shouldn't have, and the next day you just felt terrible? That's that bacteria. And because you disrupted the purity of your system. So that's what that study's about, an important study. From Thomas Jefferson University, published in Religion, Brain, and Behavior, an interesting article, and it's about spiritual retreats really do change your brain chemistry, especially dopamine and serotonin levels. What do we suffer from in America more than anything else at the social level? There are many things. I'll select one. Social isolation. I counsel a lot of people. I'm counseling a, a young gentleman now, and he's in his 20s, and he was suicidal. And in fact, he called me the night he was going to commit suicide. And I was the last person he wanted to speak with. Fortunately, our conversation ended where he decided not to commit suicide, instead to examine what led him to determining that suicide. And that was a journey he had yet to take. He had only taken the emotional consequences of that journey through life, not understanding the underlying causes. There's a big difference. I mean, you can look at a bullet in your leg and it festers and it becomes infected and you could lose your leg and you're in pain. That's one lesson. But then why did you get shot? Where did it come from? What was the motivation? Could it have been an otherwise outcome that didn't get you shot? Deeper questions we have to ask. Social isolation prevents us from even asking the question. All we do is feel the depression, the loneliness, the sense of lacking any relevance to other people. And it's worse when you're older because you're already living out an expiration date and you're getting near the end of that expiration date, what is called senescence. The end of. When you're younger, you don't think about the end of things. You think about why there's no beginning of anything, why you're not connected to things, why you're not happy in the moment you have. So therefore, a spiritual retreat could be a good thing. It can help boost mental health, and that's according to this new study I mentioned, published in Religion, Brain, and Behavior. And researchers determined that serotonin and dopamine, dope, D-O-P-amine, A-M-I-N-E, A-M-I-N-E means it's amino acid, dopamine, production is greatly affected by religious and meditative retreats. And there is the Marcus Institute for Integrative Health at Thomas Jefferson University. The researchers assert that these practices evoke powerful, positive emotional feelings. These are caused by a surge of production in the feel-good hormones of dopamine and serotonin. And that creates the love hormone. Haven't you ever noticed, no matter how bad something is, as long as you're with someone that you love or loves you and you feel good about that moment, everything seems more optimistic. We'll get through it. It's okay. It's not the end of things. And we say these things because we feel good about the associations we have. A call from someone encouraging us makes a difference. You know, even in the marathon, even in a race, you think it doesn't matter when people are cheering you? It does. Big time. Even if you can't go any faster and you're thinking, they keep saying, you can do it, you know, you put it on now, you can catch them, and you think, I'm going as fast as I can. But just their words carry an energy, and it's a positive energy. So you bring that positive energy in, and indeed you can go faster. Serotonin and dopamine are part of the reward and emotional systems of your brain. That's what's important. So when you pet your dog, hug them, or cat, or bird, and you say kind things to them over and over again, it automatically kicks in to now when they see you, their tails wag, and they feel good because you've stimulated the production of the feel-good hormones. You see someone you enjoy being with, and you know they're going to say something that's going to make you smile or laugh or feel good. It kicks in, oxytocin. And that oxytocin is the good hormone. So meditation is a part of allowing us to become mindful enough and clear our mind of all these 56,000 separate invading and unfortunately unneeded messages that we create every day. These little stories, they come and they go. But when you're mindful, you select what you want in your consciousness, and that impacts your dopamine. In fact, they found that when people went to spiritual retreats, they retained that energy and were able to feel good or better about themselves, happier, healthier. That's what it means. So then you don't feel the same as you did in social isolation. You feel connected by the positive energy of the classes and what you learned. Something that I believe a lot more people should be giving themselves a break and doing a retreat to help focus upon the positive, the life-affirming, the joyful of life. For those of you who are interested in the best way of treating cancer, I do not recommend chemotherapy for about 88% of cancers. This is from the University of Toronto. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal, Journal of Neuroscience, and it's about breast cancer drug impairs your brain function. Now, this is a comprehensive study about breast cancer drug, and it's the letrozole, L-E-T-R-O-Z-O-L-E, and reveals the side effects that impact the brain. The researchers established the common factor in all these. So what they don't tell you when they're fighting one disease, that they're actually creating a second one. And they're imbalancing the production of estrogens, and they're creating mood disturbances and memory issues. So you might have some success or not with the chemotherapy, but you're definitely going to have bad effects upon the brain. And finally, from the Russian Academy of Sciences, a new study on the medium-chain fatty acids. You find those in coconut oil, and they're saying they provide sustained energy for athletes. Now, we knew that coconut water is good because it's very high in potassium, and that's good. And watermelon juice is great. Mix the two together during a long workout, and it's really good. But now we should be adding in a teaspoon of organic coconut oil because the fat chain, the short-chain fatty acids, actually help us. And this was a study that supported that, and it's not the only study. There are other studies too. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about a new supplement discovery that works with post-traumatic stress disorder, University of South Carolina. I'll share that with you. And also tomorrow, plastics compound, the PBS, alters the mom's behavior and brain regions. University of Massachusetts got a lot to talk about tomorrow. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. And I select the music for the breaks because most radio programs, they have stupid music, uninteresting music. And I like music that a lot of us grew up to. If you're of a certain age, you appreciate when people actually had voices and talent, lyrics you can understand, and that's what I play them for. Now we have an in-depth original investigative report. Please share this with everyone you can. We will be sending this out to over 20,000 scientific journals and news agencies around the world. We'll also be sending it to the U.S. Public Health Services, each of their divisions, each of their directors, because we've been living with a lie. And this lie has cost us at least a minimum of 20 million dead Americans. When you've caused the death, preventable death, of 20 million people, that's an extraordinarily high amount of mortality, that borders then on genocide. By any measure, we are in the worst health crisis in American history. Out of a population of approximately 335 million people, two-thirds of us, adults and children both, are suffering from a wide range of health conditions, the majority of which are preventable. Our first effort at explaining how serious the conditions were, and indeed to verify that they were real, using only the mainstream medical community and the government's official figures, took several years, with a group of highly qualified board-certified physicians and academics with PhDs with deep experience in research scholarship. Up until that point, no one had compiled all the injuries and fatalities occurring as a result of medical treatment. The best that had been done was by a Dr. Lucien Lipp, a professor from Harvard, who had written a groundbreaking report that had gone virtually unchallenged and also unreported in the medical press. Later, the Journal of the American Medical Association would publish an article by Dr. Barbara Starfield showing that iatrogenesis was the third leading cause of death. And a Dr. Martin McCurry researched the same conclusions after a decade and published his findings in the British Medical Journal. However, it was surprising and disheartening to us to find that with all the medical and scientific research expertise at their researchers' disposal, they left out several important causes of death from their statistics. And iatrogenesis means medically induced. We're not talking about intent. We do not see that there's any intent to do harm, but the current medical protocols being done do harm. What this does show is that there was gross flaws in their research methodology. They simply did not adhere to high-quality scholarship. Our report was the most comprehensive to date in the United States in its history. And once completed, which took 5 years, we sent it for feedback and comment to more than 7,000 scientific publications, health reporters, and federal agencies. Not one single response was received. How's that even possible? We expected legitimate challenges and corrections, even admonitions, would have been welcome. Instead, after 7,000 different groups and magazines, Journal of the American Medical Association, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, New England Journal, all of them, Nature Magazine, Science, they all got it. All we got was dead silence. Why? Now, years have passed, and the state of American health has only worsened. The latest official reports show more heart attacks, more strokes, more obesity, and diabetes, including in children, than ever before in American history. There's more dementia, Alzheimer's, and cancer. And yet, we have spent more on health care in 2017 and 18 than we've ever spent. $3.5 trillion. That's 17.9% of the nation's gross domestic product, and a number that is on track to further increase next year, 2019. So now we're perplexed. If we tell people that we have the best healthcare system in the world with the latest technology and the most pharmaceuticals and medical procedures, the best state-of-the-art hospitals and special treatment centers, we should have a population that is far more robust and healthy, reversing critical as well as acute conditions than ever before. But this is the opposite of what has happened. Then it occurred to us that we were also missing a very important piece of this puzzle. Why are we not preventing disease? How much is all this disease actually costing the patient, corporations, and society? The figures are both staggering and heartbreaking. as there is no discussion of this anywhere. We only become invested in a person after they are sick. We only focus on a society as a society on how to alleviate the symptoms of that person suffering an illness, their symptoms. When we compare our health care program and state of the health and longevity with other developed nations, we're near dead last. How is this possible? Those individuals who brought these dire statistics to our attention have initiated no wider call for action. I'm talking about Macquarie and Starfield and LEP. Nothing has happened. Nothing. They too have been shouting into the wind. This is a dialogue we desperately need. Our new article that I'm presenting today to you that is published on PRN.fm, front and center, please share it to every federal agency, to every member of Congress, to every one of your state legislators. Everywhere you can, share this. This is the first article ever to expand, to include a discussion of iatrogenesis, its causes, prevention, and most importantly, how to resolve in part or whole all of our healthcare problems. But first to an issue that no one talks about, and that is the cost. Dr. Leap, the first well-known physician to bring the iatrogenesis problem into the limelight, only to be largely ignored by the medical industry. They didn't attack him. They didn't say he was wrong. He was a Harvard professor, published in many peer-reviewed journals, and did outstanding scholarship on this. This took him a long time. He thought that someone would pay attention. No one did. But he notes that while some progress has been made, the situation is by no means resolved. Indeed, it has gotten much worse since 2009. Thanks to skyrocketing premiums introduced by the Affordable Care Act and unaccompanied by an increase in quality of care. Depending upon the study, medical error is estimated to cost anywhere from $20 billion to $980 billion a year. That's a significant spread, and that's a significant sum by any measure. Our calculations place those costs somewhere in the middle. So every year, just on the basic question of the mistakes we're making and what it means and what's this costing us, it's $440 billion a year that we could be saving. But that is probably a low estimate, given how few of the medical errors that take place are actually ever reported. But what about when everything goes according to plan? That $440 billion is a mere drop in the bucket compared to the staggering $3.5 trillion Americans spent on health care in just last year. More than twice the amount the next two countries spent on health care combined, and almost 18% of the U.S.'s gross domestic product. According to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year, that compared the U.S. with 10 other wealthy countries, we spend more than 400% on administrative cost, up to 300% more on pharmaceuticals, and yet we achieve the lowest life expectancy of all of them, with the average American living only 78.8 years. That's it. While the mean of all the other 11 advanced nations was 81.7, and some nations are much higher than that. We also have the highest infant mortality rate at 5.8 deaths per 1,000 live births. That's like Bangladesh. How's that possible? Why is this not being discussed? According to the CDC, which does not track iatrogenic deaths and heart disease, is the leading cause of death in the United States, accounting for one in every four deaths and killing about 634,000 Americans. When one adds the deaths from stroke to the total, the number climbs to nearly 800,000, amounting to one in three American lives every year are lost from heart disease and stroke. How much does that cost us? Just those two. $550 billion a year in health care services, medications, and lost productivity. That's a half a trillion dollars a year from just one disease with two manifestations, stroke and heart attacks. The American Heart Association believes these costs could double in the near future and, quote, could bankrupt our nation economy and healthcare system, according to the American Heart Association president, Dr. Stephen Hauser. Quote, the fact that the CVD could single-handedly bankrupt our nation's healthcare system is disturbing, Hauser said. But it's a real possibility if we don't act soon to do a better job of preventing what are largely preventable disorders. That's from the top American Heart Association. In our medical investigation, we found that the system, the medical system, doctors are not rewarded for preventing any disease. There is no medical billing code for a clean bill of health. Doctors who keep their patients out of the hospital are, if anything, punished by being deprived of the cash that flows to their peers in in-demand specialty fields like oncology and cardiology. Thus, expecting doctors to shift to a preventive care model without also fixing a system that only rewards treatments of the already sick is expecting doctors to take food out of their own mouths. Cancer is the second leading cause of death, according to the CDC, with 595,930 Americans dying in the most recent year reported. But the direct medical cost of that same year was $80.2 billion. Because more people develop cancer every year, total care costs are expected to reach $173 billion next year. Just for cancer, that's just how much it costs to treat the cancer, $173 billion. And while not as financially devastating as heart disease, at almost a half a trillion, this is another condition we are exacerbating as a society by failing to address the causes or arrest the onset of the disease until the patient's already sick. All of this suffering and expenditure could be avoided if the profit motive was removed from healthcare. But too many people are benefiting on too many levels from the current model for meaningful change to occur. Now, since the publication of the original Death by Medicine in 2009, other reports have periodically surfaced to remind the medical industry of the scope of the iatrogenesis problems. And like ours, these warnings have largely gone unheeded, sinking without a trace in the ever-widening money pool of medical spending. In 2016, Martin Makary of Johns Hopkins University wrote to Dr. Thomas Friedman, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to request the agency include medical error on its list of causes of death published every year. Makary had published a study earlier that year in the British Medical Journal revealing that a minimum of 251,454 deaths are attributable to medical error annually. He emphasized that this figure was low because it only included patients who died in hospitals and did not include outpatient deaths or deaths that occurred after discharge. And that could easily be as high a number. After all, remember, all the figures we're sharing with you today in our report are only from inside of a hospital. So let's say you get a drug and you go home, and a week later you die of a heart attack because of the drug, or liver failure because of the drug. That will not be a part of any statistic. So the figures are much higher. In his letter, Makary and his colleagues merely requested the CDC allow clinicians to list medical error as a cause of death on death certificates, given its prevalence. The current model limits recording options to diseases, morbid conditions, and injuries, as itemized by the International Classification of Diseases billing codes. While the cause are not found on that list, those he calls human and system factors in medical care are excluded. He recommends an additional field on death certificates, that would indicate whether preventable complications of medical care were the primary cause of death, allowing a fuller picture of the circumstances without necessarily creating a liability for the doctor. Bringing the high rate of medical error into the open, Macquarie hopes will bring to bear the forces needed to begin to solve the problem. Government funding flows to cancer and heart disease research, while medical error is a forgotten backwater discussed only in hospital committees. The proverbial elephant in the room sucking up all the air while the medical profession hesitates to even speak its name. Being able to share best practices and avoid worst practices can only help both patients and doctors. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, literally, in this case. Of course, he received zero response from the CDC, which is a purely political elephant. So progress? Well, Professor Lepp, who was honored by the National Patient Safety Foundation in 2007 for the founding of the Lucien Lepp Institute to study healthcare safety, is losing patience with the industry he's worked in all of his professional life. Quote, "It is incomprehensible to me that hospitals can continue not to follow practices that are known to make a real difference," end quote. He told health leaders, he believes a depoliticized regulatory agency is the solution to the medical industry's problems. A group with powers to inspect and discipline, but not no conflicts of interest to prevent them from doing their job. And he suggests regulators not underestimate the value of shaming public reporting in encouraging compliance with safety standards. In effect, he is saying, to my reasoning, that we have agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, National Institutes of Aging, all under the umbrella of the U.S. public health system, that are highly politicized and profitized. You look at almost any committee investigating anything involving a therapy, and you'll find it loaded with pro-pharmaceutical industry scientists and doctors. And they're not about to challenge the legitimacy, the safety and efficacy of the drugs that their companies make. So you don't have an FDA that is clean and transparent, or CDC. That is the problem. So like Macquarie, Lepp believes it's time to leave the Institute of Medicine's figures of 98,000 iatrogenic deaths behind and adapt a more realistic number. Now, we will be sending to the head of the Library of Medicine our article, which completely documents and has been independently vetted for scholarship, our more accurate figures. My hope is that they'll use them. NASA toxicologist John T. James estimated 440,000 deaths caused by major medical error per year, supported by these and other experts. However, they admit that even the global trigger tool James used does not catch all medical errors, particularly those that represent actions that should have been taken but weren't. The true number of medically induced deaths is much higher. Indeed, our calculations found it was more than double James's statistic. Yet the medical industry forges ahead with business as usual, in which they take credit for all healing, but eschew responsibility for all complications, up to and including death. They cannot have it both ways, yet that has not stopped them from trying. An individual who receives the flu vaccine and does not get the flu is not praised for living a healthier lifestyle, adhering to a healthy plant-based diet, exercising every day, getting enough sleep. But even if he does get the flu, it must have been something he did. Writ large, this is the story of the entire medical industry. So if you could take the flu vaccine and you live a very healthy life and you don't get the flu, you're given no credit. The vaccine's given 100% of the credit. But if you take the flu vaccine and you get the flu, you're blamed for it. This is the game they've been playing for as long as I've been in the health field. I consider defending the indefensible. Dr. Hader Warwick, a cardiologist at Duke University, published an editorial in last week's New York Times. From my personal perspective, it epitomizes this head-in-the-sand approach to medical harms. He reflexively defends ineffective treatments the medical establishment is starting to cast aside while dismissing patients who seek to better understand their conditions by doing their own research as gullible and superstitious peasants who need a medical specialist like himself to lead them out of the wilderness. The graphic that accompanies his op-ed says it all. An angry-looking, overweight woman depicted in red tones, her face lit up even redder in the glow of her iPhone, towering over a white-coated doctor one-third her size. The patients who research the treatments prescribed for them, even though they are clearly unhealthy and in need of healing, are questioning the received wisdom of the doctor as interpreter of divine will. They're effectively cheating on him with their iPhones, and that's unforgivable. Even though the major scientific journals publish their studies online, most often for a fee, the internet is reduced to a swamp of false information. Surely the patient off the shining path illuminated by the medical profession. The doctor focuses on statins in his praise of the medical orthodoxy. He describes a patient who has a minor heart attack after neglecting to take her medication because of, quote, scary things she had read about statins on the internet, claiming any of the drug's adverse effects can be ascribed to, quote, nocebo effects. The doctor defends the drugs, the statins, and even proposes criminalizing the spread of information on their harms. In 2015, Doctors Diamond and Ravsnuff destroyed the case for statins with the seminal article in Expert Review of Clinical Pharmacology that deconstructs how Americans were tricked into embracing statins as a miracle drug for preventing heart attacks. While they acknowledge the effectiveness of the drugs in lowering cholesterol levels, they call into question the accepted wisdom that high cholesterol is a causative factor in cardiovascular disease. The researchers cite dozens of studies published in peer-reviewed medical literature and outline a diabolically clever campaign of statistical deception using a statistical tool called relative risk reduction. During a 2008 Juniper trial of Crestor by AstraZeneca, which sponsored the study, by the way, a minuscule difference in the rate of heart attacks between the control group and the drug groups was recast statistically as a difference in what it could be. Now, how's that work? Let me explain this. Even though more people actually died of heart attacks who were using the drug than in the control group, quote, listen carefully. Because this is the game they play. Quote, regarding fatal and non-fatal coronary heart disease, less than 0.5%. Let me repeat that. Less than 0.5%. We're talking about 0.5%. 0.5% of the treated population benefited from the Crestor treatment, and 244 people needed to be treated to prevent a single fatal or non-fatal heart attack. Despite this meager effect, in the media, the benefit was stated as more than, quote, more than 50% avoided a fatal heart attack. How's that possible? Because 0.41% is 54% of 0.76%. That's the game they play. Worse, the drug group displayed an increase in diabetes. Although the number of incidences was small, they were not treated in the same statistical magic as the dip in heart attacks. A patient's cancer risk increases with statin treatment, and a link with central nervous system disease has also emerged. The more statins you take, the more that occurs. More than one statin trial ended up with an increase in suicidal or violent deaths among subjects treated with the drug. The researchers note that low blood cholesterol levels are prevalent among, quote, criminals in people with diagnosis of violent or aggressive conduct disorders and homicidal offenders with histories of violence and suicide attempts related to alcohol, and in the people with poor internalized social norms and low self-control, end quote, as well as other psychiatric disorders. So now you're saying that based upon a person's conditioning, if they take your drug, they're more likely to kill someone or themselves or do some injury or act out in some way. Yet there's no science behind that. Cognitive impairments and problems are closely linked with statin treatment to the extent that discontinuing the drugs often alleviates the symptoms. A Dr. Padala and his associates tested their hypothesis in a study discontinuing statins in a group of patients with Alzheimer's disease. 12 weeks later, the study's participants were performing markedly better on cognitive tests when they had given up their statins. When placed back on the statins, their cognition deteriorated again to its previous level. Statins deplete the body of coenzyme Q10 and selenium, two essential nutrients required for proper heart and nerve function. Coenzyme Q10 deficiency manifests in the muscle and joint pain experienced by many statin patients and contributes to aging. As the nutrient is a powerful antioxidant that normally protects DNA from free radical damage, and as statins lower the body's coenzyme Q10 levels, heart and nerve function declines. The consequence is the neurodegenerative side effects so many researchers have observed. Selenium deficiency is associated with an increased risk of cancer. Another side effect of statins the medical industrial complex has unsuccessfully tried to sweep under the rug. These are not mere chance events unrelated to the actions of the drugs, nor are they some nocebo effect conjured through the black magic of internet research. No. The packaging and selling of statins to healthy people as, quote, an anti-atherosclerotic insurance is one of the most egregious frauds perpetrated on the American public in recent decades. An advisory group, the Cholesterol Treatment Trialist Collaborators, suggested expanding the pool of patients recommended for statin therapy, since even the least at-risk population could be shown, quote, using the aforementioned statistical trickery to benefit. And while a revision shifted the primary treatment criteria from LDL C levels to risk associated, that takes into account other health factors for individual patients, this refactoring had the effect of increasing the number of Americans taking statins, not decreasing it. And by 2016, fully half of men ages 60 and older were taking statin drugs, up from 36% just 10 years earlier. And the percentage of women taking the drugs, statin drugs, has increased more slowly from 33 to 38%. So a further revision of treatment guidelines issued by the American Heart Association earlier this year actually emphasized, quote, a heart-healthy lifestyle before mentioning statin drugs. This was a monumental shift given the exclusively pharmaceutical focus of most American medicine. Yet the doctor from the New York Times, Dr. Wirtz, does not utter a word in favor of lifestyle measures such as plant-based low-calorie diets, regular exercise, and stress management. To posit that such natural interventions might have a beneficial effect on his cardiac patients is heresy to the pharmaceutically faithful. It is not enough that the next 9 points of treatment in the new American Heart Association guidelines deal with when and how to prescribe statins. The doctor and his colleagues cannot monetize a healthy lifestyle, and it is anathema to their pharmaceutical-based view of medicine, in my opinion. That the American Heart Association guidelines for managing cardiovascular disease with cholesterol-lowering therapies even mention lifestyle changes at all is an encouraging development. Their common sense recommendations present an island of sanity in an ocean of big pharma faith healing. Quote, patients should consume a dietary pattern that emphasizes intake of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, healthy protein sources, low-fat dairy products, and low-fat poultry without skin, fish, seaweed, nuts, and non-tropical vegetable oils, and limit intake of sweets, sugar-sweetened beverages, and red meats. This dietary pattern should be adjusted to appropriate caloric requirements. Personal and cultural food preferences and nutritional therapy for other medical conditions, including diabetes. Caloric intake should be adjusted to avoid overweight gain or in overweight obese patients. To promote weight loss, in general, adults should be advised to engage in aerobic physical activity 3 to 4 sessions per week, lasting an average of 40 minutes per session and involving moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity, end quote. Well, that's what the American Heart Association said, and I'm glad they said that. Tomorrow, part 2, Death by Medicine, we'll take it from there, giving you the truth about how bad the medical-industrial complex is and how dangerous it is to our health and well-being. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.